Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Deborah Adianju, a member of the club's Bay Gourmet Forum, and your program chair for tonight. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Ms. Michaela Rodino. So by way of background, Ms. Rodino has spent more than four decades in the wine industry. During her illustrious career, she has played key roles at two iconic French-owned wineries in Napa, namely Domaine Chandon and Saint-Exupéry. And to say she's been a trailblazer is really an understatement. So at Chandon, one of Michaela's signature accomplishments was to create the industry's first relationship marketing program. After that, she went on to take her customer focus and her innovative approach to brand building to Saint-Exupéry as that winery's first CEO. Today, Michaela co-owns and runs her family winery, Villa Ragazzi, which is in Napa. She also has somehow found time to write a memoir about her experience in the wine business, and it is titled, From Bubbles to Boardrooms, Serendipitous Stories from Inside the Wine Business. The book will be available for purchase just after this program, and Michaela will be signing copies. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Ms. Michaela Rodino.
Thank you. Thank you, Deborah, and thank all of you for coming out on this lovely evening to listen to me and Deborah and drink some really good wine. All the wines we have here tonight are wines that I've had my fingers in one way or another. The Chandon is from the early part of my career. The Chandon Rosé is back there. I hope you tried that. And the Rosato di Sangiovese is from our family winery, Villa Ragazzi. The Faraona, which is the only red wine, that we have here tonight, is also from our family winery. And there's at the end of the program, we're going to be serving some Saint-Exupéry Moscato, which has a little bit of sweetness to it. So it's kind of a nice way to finish off an evening. So, serendipity. The subtitle of my book is Serendipitous Stories from Inside the Wine Business, and serendipity is something that has been extremely important in my life, and I had no idea it would be, but it has been and it continues to be. And various people who have reviewed my book for me, some of whom are in this room, I'm not going to make you raise your hand. You know who you are. I got a lot of help with this book. told me what the book was. When I started off to write a book, let me back up. It was suggested to me probably 25 years ago that I write a book about the wine industry. And I thought, oh, what a good idea. I like to write. I would love to write a book. And then I thought, but I don't want to write a book about the wine industry. And besides, I just started this new job at Saint-Exupéry. I have two small children. I don't have any spare capacity to do anything additional. Forget it, you know. But I filed it away in the back of my head. And when I did have time, after I finally retired from my day job about 6.5 years ago, I started really thinking hard about it. I didn't do what most people do, smart people do, and that is start collecting notes over the years while you're thinking about writing a book. So I didn't have any of that. But what I did have, when I started to think about the book, I realized that I remembered a lot of incidents, just things that happened over the course of my career. And I'm not that good at remembering things. So if I remembered something, there was a reason why. And it was pointed out to me that the reason why is because those things had lessons embedded in them. I remembered them because I had learned something that I really needed to learn. And as it turned out, many of those things have a certain universal character to them because we all apparently have the same things to learn in many cases. So this book is a book of anecdotal just stories of my experiences. It is not in any way a history of the wine business, except as sort of a background of all the changes going on in the wine industry over these 40 years. So that's interesting in and of itself. But the point of the story, which I don't bother to make to you, you get to figure that out for yourself, is that there's something valuable here. In fact, one of my reviewers very kindly said that this book is like an MBA in between two covers. Small book. And I thought, oh, well, that would be a lot easier than going back to Berkeley for two more years. But it was too late for me. I'd already done that. So anyway, serendipity. Big, big word here. Now, my definition of serendipity is the right people being in the right time at the right place. All three elements coming together If only two of them are there, it doesn't work. You've got to have all three, and then boom, you've got a serendipitous thing going on. And my very first experience with serendipity, conscious experience with serendipity, was when I stumbled into the wine business in 1973. My husband Gregory, who's back there pouring wine, is responsible for us arriving in Napa Valley in 1972 because he liked wine. And we had both just recently graduated, him from Davis Law School and me from the master's program in French literature. He knew what to do with his degree, but I certainly had no idea what to do with mine. So when he said, oh, there's an opening in a firm in Napa, let's go there, I thought, Napa. Oh, Napa, I don't know, you know. For someone who graduated from high school in the Bay Area, Napa in the 60s meant, anybody know? The funny farm. Yeah, the state hospital for the mentally impaired or whatever. It's now the state hospital for the criminally insane, but, you know, they've sort of amped it up a little bit. But that was the reputation of Napa in the 60s, okay? It wasn't good. So I dutifully followed my young husband off to Napa, wondering what he was thinking. And as it turned out, that was a very serendipitous thing to do because the Napa Valley was just reawakening after many, many decades of being nowhere, nothing happening. It was just one disaster after another from a thriving period in the late 1800s through being destroyed by phylloxera, to World War I, through the Depression, through Prohibition. I mean, it was just one thing after another. Those are in the wrong order, but you see what I'm saying. It wasn't really until the mid-60s when Robert Mondavi built his winery that anything new happened in the wine industry, and there were a few survivors who had limped through all of this other stuff for decades. So our timing turned out to be pretty good. Hi, Nick. He sneaked in late. Typical restaurant guy. I should say typical wine guy, actually. So we just stumbled into Napa at the right moment when things were really starting to happen again in wine. And, of course, I knew nothing about wine. I'd spent my junior year abroad in Bordeaux, actually, and learned to drink wine the way French people do who don't have enough money to really get into it. You know, you just drink it because it's on the table and it's a beverage that goes with your meals. But there's a lot more to that. And once we got to Napa, I suddenly realized that could be a really good opportunity for me. I had no idea how good it was going to be. Serendipity strikes. 6 months after we moved to Napa, Moët Hennessy announces that they're going to build a new winery in Napa. Moët Hennessy being Moët et Chandon, big champagne house, and Hennessy being Hennessy Cognac, right? French people. Bringing millions of dollars to Napa. And the only thing I could do was speak French. Yay! So I said, I think this is an opportunity, she says. Well, this was before the internet, before networking, before anything like that. So the grapevine in Napa was thriving along. So it took me about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks, to find the founder of this new business who was working out of his garage up on Mount Feeder. All by himself. He had a couple of hippies from La Jolla planting grapevines, but that was kind of it. And I just got in the old, it wasn't old at that point, the Alfa Romeo and roared up Mount Veeder and knocked on the garage door and said to this person who I had finally discovered who he was, his name was John Wright, and I said, hey, I speak French. Do you need help? And he looked at me. He was kind of surprised by this attack, and he looked at me and he said, yeah, I guess I do. I thought, all right, I've got a job. So I spent 3 years working with John under the radar, basically, building what would become Domaine Chandon. It was a wonderful experience, I have to tell you. France would send over millions of dollars. This is good. We would spend it on planting vineyards and designing a winery. Of course, we had to go off to Champagne and visit lots of wineries to make sure we were going to do it right. You know, this was good. You know, making wine, we actually, I don't know how many of you get up to Napa very often, but the old Trefethen Winery had been standing empty since the 1950s when we came along. They had lots of grapes to sell, and they had an empty old historic winery with a dirt floor. And we were in a big hurry to start making wine. This was in 1973, so we just said, hey, we'll buy grapes from you, because they wanted to make wine too. He said, we'll buy your grapes if you'll let us furnish your winery and make our wine here until we can finish building our winery. And they said, oh, good idea. So we did that. And that's how we got kind of a big head start. And by 1977, we were opening the winery, Domaine Chandon, which had a restaurant, which is not supposed to happen in the Ag Preserve, very tightly controlled zoning in Napa. That's a story. If I have time, I'll tell you that story. I did that. It was really fun. I didn't do it all. I was the sacrificial lamb who was sent in front of the Planning Commission to plead the case for allowing a restaurant in the Ag Preserve, which actually happened, amazingly enough. This was at a time when there weren't any good restaurants in Napa, so that may have had something to do with it. It's a possibility. Anyway, so the first piece of serendipity is Moët Hennessy dropping out of the sky. That was very good. The second piece of serendipity was that my new boss, John Wright, turned out to be the perfect boss for me. I mean, if I had been working for somebody who was in any way different from him, and he was close to being crazy, it probably wouldn't have worked out. He did this more than once. It wasn't just me. He looked, when he hired people, he didn't care if you had any work experience. This is pretty unusual. He cared if you had some energy and a good mind, and the experience will come. And I thought, okay, I fit that mold. Yeah, I could do that. And he did that repeatedly, and almost all the time it worked out really well. And once in a while, he'd pick a bad one who had to go. But it was a very odd place to work because we were just running amok, essentially. And every now and then I would send off a report to Paris once they sent us a plaintive letter saying, what's going on over there? Because you know? This was time when people wrote letters. They didn't. Nobody would pick up the phone to call Paris, right? It just, that was, somebody had to die to get on the phone internationally. And, you know, no electronics available. So it was all letters. And so they basically, it was a very hands-off relationship with Moët Hennessy, mainly because there wasn't anything they could do about it, short of coming to visit us themselves. They did send us a winemaker, which was a good idea because we could kind of wing it with the rest of the business, but making champagne, sparkling wine, in the way you're supposed to, you really need to know what you're doing, okay? And so they sent this wonderful guy named Edmond Modier over, who was the first flying winemaker, and he would go back and forth every couple of months and taste wines. And he also was having an absolutely wonderful time working with us because there are no rules in California, right? Compared to Champagne. He was a hog in clover. It was just great. Or whatever it is that likes clover. Probably not hogs. Anyway, so it was a very unusual place to work, and a lot of people thrived there. But you had to be able to sort of thrive on no boundaries, lots of shades of gray, lots of ambiguity, lots of change, a real bent toward innovation. It was just not the kind of place most of us end up working, unless you're really lucky, and unless you like that kind of stuff. The good thing is people who don't like that kind of stuff self-select out very quickly because it makes them uncomfortable not to have borders. But basically, you could do anything you wanted to do. So after a certain amount of time, I said to John, because it was apparent to me that there was a need for someone to deal with the press, because we were this big story. It was, you know, all these millions of dollars coming in from a big company in France. Nobody knew where we were or what we were doing until we opened the winery. But everybody wanted to know. There were little whispers going on, and the press started writing stories. They'd make them up because they wanted to write a story about it. So I finally said, you know, we really ought to do something about this. We should tell them what we're doing, right? So they at least get it right. And so that's how I kind of backed into marketing and ended up, after getting my MBA at Haas, became the vice president of marketing, which was very glorious and lots of fun. So that whole first part of the book is all about those early days of Domaine Chandon. And that's why it's entitled Startups Are Such Fun. That was an amazing startup, and it was so much fun. There's still a group of alumni that get together every year that call themselves the Domaniacs. Just to give you the flavor of the group, you know? So anyway, that was a really fun part of the book for me to write. I enjoyed it. There are millions of stories in there. We were just making it up as we went along. I'll just tell you one of my favorites, and that was when we were building the winery, and the architects wanted the winery to blend into the environment, which was a fairly new thing at that time. And it was on a rocky, sort of hilly site, and they didn't want it right within sight of the highway, they wanted it sort of tucked back out of sight so it wouldn't be intrusive. But they wanted to use those native rocks, which were really great. They wanted those to be in the walls, and that's fine, but the rocks were all up on these steep hillsides on the winery property, and it would be very dangerous to try to get them down from there to the winery site itself with a tractor. I mean, somebody would die. That thing would roll. So we were thinking around, well, how are we going to get those rocks down here? And I said, well, let's get a team of mules and haul them out of the hills like they used to in the old days. And everybody said, oh, that's a good idea. So I looked around for a while for a team of mules, couldn't find any. They're not that easy to find. And then I remembered that Rene DeRosa, the owner of Winery Lake, had a percheron, a pet percheron, living in the pasture out behind his house with two longhorn steers. They were all pets. And I said, percherons, those are draft horses. They're meant to haul things, heavy things, right? I'm going to go ask Rene if I can borrow his horse. So I go off to see Rene. We were buying grapes from him. He's a wonderful guy. I miss him a lot. And he said, he was thrilled. He really loved the idea of us borrowing Dapples, that was his name, to haul all these rocks out of the hills. There was only one problem, and that is that Dapples had never been broken to halter, much less trained to do anything. He was a pet. He was a 5-year-old, 2,000-pound pet with feet this big. So that's just a small problem. So I found a 17-year-old girl who had once trained a saddle horse to train Dapples. And she did. I saw her kick him in the stomach once with her cowboy boots when he wasn't paying attention to her. The look on his face was wonderful. He looked so surprised. It didn't hurt. Clearly it didn't hurt, but it did get his attention. And then I had to find somebody who could build a harness. We found an old collar in the corner of a dusty old barn somewhere. And this guy up in Calistoga built a harness out of chains and miscellaneous pieces of bits. And then the winery mechanic, who had grown up in the Midwest, remembered what stone boats look like and built a stone boat. So we hitched, let Dapples, you know, he thought all of this was really fun. He loved all the attention, you know, was really enjoying it. They're very good-natured draft horses and very willing. So he took to all of this without any problem until we hooked him up to the stone boat and asked him to move on. And the stone boat didn't have anything in it, so it clattered behind him and scared him. And he took off like a rocket. And of course, the faster he went, the louder it got. He was gone, you know. So this went on for quite a while with no success until finally somebody had the bright idea that we should load the stone boat, put a lot of stones on it, you know, and slow him down. And that did it. He couldn't run away because he couldn't haul them off. He just couldn't carry that much weight. So he pulled all those rocks down from the hill. And you should go by Chandon sometime and look at those walls. They are quite extensive. And every single one of those bloody rocks came down off the hills thanks to Dapples. There's a picture of him in the book hauling. It's really neat to see a draft horse leaning into a collar like that. It was really cool. But that's kind of typical of the things we did. You know, we would do things just because they needed to get done, and we didn't know how to do them, so we would just make it up. Doesn't everybody? It was a kinder, gentler time. I mean, you couldn't get in too much trouble. Another thing, just as another example that we did, Pinot Noir in California, you know, it's a warmer climate than in Champagne. Pinot Noir is the grape, you know, the sort of big noble grape in Champagne, Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. But the Pinot Noirs in California, because of our climate, are very hard to make as a white wine. They want to pick up some color from the skins, no matter how careful you are. So, okay, we were trying to make a typical Brut cuvée, which would have looked white in the Champagne-y sort of, not white like a piece of paper, but white like the walls over there, the upper part of the walls. But it just was really hard to do. So what we did for those first cuvées was just to separate out the lightest lots of Pinot Noir that we had for all our efforts to try to make white wine out of black grapes. And then the ones that were more colored, we set aside because we didn't want to get too much color into the one that was supposed to be white. And we made a second cuvée that had a noticeable color to it. And we were going to call it Blanc de Noir because that means white wine, singular, out of black grapes. Noir has an S on the end of it. And we were standing there in the lab at Trefethen one night when Dr. Ralph Kunke from UC Davis showed up to taste the new wines. Everybody was really interested in this project, so we got a lot of visitors. And he says, well, you know, this one over here, this white one, yeah, that's good. It had some Chardonnay in it, too. And this one that's all Pinot Noir and has a noticeable color, he says, you know, the color's all wrong on that. You can't make that wine. That's just not going to work. And we all went, it tastes good. We like it. And so we just put it out there. We released both those wines together, the first crack out of the bag, and both of them were just readily accepted by the American public, who really, at that moment in history, didn't know much about the fine points of making champagne in France. So there wasn't a lot of comparison going on there anyway. And it went fine, and it basically created a whole new type of sparkling wine, Blanc de Noir. So thank you very much, Dr. Kunke, for your advice. I mean, we did so many other things. We did the first road trip for vintners together in Napa. Napa has a... Oh, I'm supposed to stop and tell you, for the people who are... This is an announcement. I would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Sips and Reflections with Michaela Rodino. Thank you. This is being recorded. They're not kidding. Okay. So, Moët decided that they were going to help us introduce Chandon, and to do that, they loaned us their corporate jet. Yay. Which was a Falcon 10. And after a week of, for a month, with the pilot, the French pilot, and after a week of flying wine writers in from New York and Texas and anywhere I could find one, which there weren't that many in those days, then I had three more weeks of jet time and no real great ideas about what to do with it. And I don't remember, to tell you the truth, if it was me or John who said, oh, let's take it on the road. Let's take the show on the road. And I thought, oh, okay, let's do that. So the big difference was that instead of doing it just by ourselves, we invited fellow vintners to come with us. So it really made an impact, because at that point you didn't have bands of vintners flying all over the country together making, you know, like 100 Sonoma wineries showing up in New York one day to do a whole big event. So we did a 7-city tour of the United States with 6 or 7 vintners who we brought along, Louis Martini and Michael Mondavi and Tom Burgess and Jack Cakebread. God, I can't even remember who else. There were a couple of others. Jerry Looper, yeah, Montalena, thank you. Anyway, there's a picture of him in the book, actually. He gave it to me. I made them paint the logo of Moët on the fuselage of the plane in case there were any photo opportunities, you know. But that was really fun. But it was the kind of thing we could do. And these things all made a difference because they just hadn't been done before. Now it sounds kind of commonplace, but it's all over the place now. And we made the Chandon Club. This is how I worked with John Wright. He was a fountain of ideas. Every day his favorite idea was the one he heard 2 seconds ago. You know, so he was always changing his mind, always waiting for the better opportunity, the better idea to pop up. So my self-appointed job was to sort of do some triage there and pick out the ideas that I thought had legs and were doable and then just make them happen. Because, I mean, seriously, this was a constant barrage of ideas. And I kind of had a little rule of thumb, almost subconsciously. The first time I heard an idea, I just didn't even listen to it. The second time I heard it, I thought, oh, I've heard that before somewhere. And the third time I thought, oh, he must really mean that one, because he remembers he remembers it well enough to say it 3 times. So the 3-time ideas were the ones that I paid the most attention to. And one of those was, let's start a club. And I said, what? What do you mean, start a club? He didn't know either. He had no idea what he meant. This was about 2 years after American Airlines started their Advantage program, so I think that might have been the genesis of his idea. So I thought, well, all right, we have to start a club somehow or try, so let's figure this out. You know. So we got on the phone. We had a mailing list, and we got on the phone and talked to about 100 people around the country and asked them what they would like in a club, if we had a club. And we had all these ideas about things we could do for them at the winery, but what they really wanted us to do was come to them. Because most people only came out to Napa once in a while, you know, and so all those winery privileges were really not that useful to them. So we said, okay. So we said, all right, this club is going to be free, but you have to opt in. We didn't even know that terminology then. We just said, you have to say that, yes, you accept this invitation. Then we sent them a little membership card. And then we went on the road. We took the winery on the road and drank a lot of Chandon with people all over the country and had a wonderful time. newsletters to keep in touch. I mean, this is all very low tech because there was no tech at that point. But it made a huge difference. It was a very engaging thing. And we ended up within 3 or 4 years with about 100,000 people all over the country who thought they were the best friends, the best personal friends of Domaine Chandon. And they were, in a way, except that there were an awful lot of them. You know, it worked out very well. And just shortly before I left, a couple of years before I left Chandon, I took it upon myself to do a survey of the Chandon Club to see who they were and what they do, and you know, you sort of marketing stuff. So I wrote this very dense survey, you know, 4 pages, asking them everything I could think of, and there's 1 page of it in the appendix of the book, and sent it out to all 100,000 people. It would have taken somebody who reads and writes quickly at least half an hour to fill it out because it was pretty intense. And we got 6,000 of those things back on paper, which caused another problem, which was, now what do we do with all this data? You know? By that time, John Wright had an Apple II. Oh, boy. So, and a class in statistics from somewhere, you know, way back. And so we hired a kid to do the data input into the Apple II, and then he crunched the numbers, and we found out that the Chandon Club was responsible for probably 25% of the winery sales globally, which was a big surprise and certainly justified all the effort we were putting into it. And that we weren't even selling them wine because it wasn't legal then. It was all about the relationship. You know, wine clubs now are very different. They're much more transaction-oriented. I mean, the good ones are very engaging, but most of them are just, hey, buy my wine, you know, book of the month club kind of thing. Anyway, that was a pretty exciting thing. So we were doing, there's tons more. Can't spend the whole night talking about that. Anyway, that's the first part of the book. That's the really fun stuff. In fact, that's why I subtitled the first part of the book, Startups Are Such Fun. And they really are. I mean, the right ones are. Some of them are pretty hair-raising, but this one was really fun. Act Two is subtitled Becoming a CEO. And that's a lot less fun, I have to tell you, than startups. Even though this was also a startup, you have so much more responsibility if you're the guy on deck that it's you have to work a lot harder at making it fun. And I did try, believe me. I inherited some people at Saint-Supery who really weren't into having fun. And I came out of a background where, you know, every Friday afternoon by 3 o'clock, somebody was popping a bottle of Chandon saying, okay, the weekend's here, right? And everybody would get together, and there was a lot of mixing from different departments, and it was a very collegial kind of wonderful thing. It didn't go on long, you know, maybe an hour, but it made a big difference. It was a wonderful kind of thing to do with bonding people. Well, I tried that with my inherited crew at Saint-Supery, and it was the funniest experience. I got some Chandon, and I said, okay, at 4 o'clock on Friday afternoon, we'll all get together and have a glass of wine, and won't that be fun? And, you know, get to know one another a little better, because I was newer to this organization than they were, which was still very much in formation. So I'm standing there with a flute of Chandon in my hand, and these, a whole bunch of, they were almost all men, are standing in a sort of shallow semicircle around me like this. And I'm standing there waiting for someone to say something, and they're all looking at me like, now what do we do? They didn't even drink the wine. Anyway, different culture. So we changed that, or actually they changed it. Most of them moved on voluntarily because they thought I was just not the kind of person they wanted to work for. Worked fine for me. That was good. Anyway, it was a very different operation there. I walked in just as the French owners, who I'd met while I was at Chandon, were getting ready to launch their first wines. They had planted the vineyards and they had built a winery. The public parts weren't finished yet, but the production parts were. And they had some new wines. They had outsourced a marketing and business plan, and they were ready to go. And my first job was to taste through the wines and review the marketing, not the marketing plan, it was really a business plan, and tell the owners, the proud owners, who had already sunk 6 years of their lives into this multi-million-dollar project, what I thought. So I tasted the wines, and I went, ooh. And I looked at the plan, and I went, ooh. And I had to tell my new boss that I thought it would be a big mistake to launch on those wines, because first impressions last a long time, and those were not going to be very strong first impressions. And then I had to tell him that his label, which had his name in it, was a really bad label. This is, you know, really sticking my neck out with my new boss. And then I told him that the business plan, even if it was successful, would never make any money. because it was based on the premise that you had to sell a lot of volume at really low prices. And you could certainly sell a lot of volume at really low prices, but you're never going to make any money doing that, which was, of course, the object of the exercise, is to make some money someday. So this new boss, Robert Scali, I thought I was... I didn't feel like I was taking a big risk. I was just telling him what I thought because I thought it was my job to tell him what I thought. I wasn't thinking, you know, you're probably going to get fired over this before you even get started. And he just looked at me and he said, okay, we'll wait for the next vintage. You've got a year to fix all this stuff. And I said, good. That was wonderful. So I got to spend a whole year without having to sit on an airplane, which was wonderful for me. I really liked that. And to just get in there and figure out what this place was going to become. And it wasn't like Domaine Chandon, which was sort of grown as a child of Moët & Chandon kind of a company. You knew what it was going to be because it had this heritage behind it. Well, with the Scalis, their wine businesses in France were so different from what we were doing in Napa that there really wasn't any synergy there at all. So we had to invent the whole thing. We had to come up with a new name, and we had to come up with a business plan, and we had to figure out what we could do best and all that stuff. So that was interesting and fun, but it was very different, and if anything, rather harder, at least for me it was anyway. But still, I brought with me that whole mindset that, you know, developed over 15 years at Domaine Chandon of really favoring change and innovation and flexibility and not putting people in boxes and, you know, trying to hire people who have, you know, innate talent rather than people who have already done a job and just find out what they could do. Because that really worked for me, you know. It doesn't work for everybody, but it worked for me, and I knew it would work for other people because I worked with a bunch of them at Chandon. So that's the kind of people who I was looking for at Saint-Supery. And I did find a number of people like that, and I did what had been done for me. I said, okay, here's the problem. Fix it. You know, come up with a solution. Come and talk to me if you want to. You know, I leave it up to you to decide whether you want to, you know, check in with me on this or not. And most people really rose to the challenge. The right people for that organization did. The wrong people, again, self-selected out. They just couldn't stand the ambiguity of a situation like that. Anyway, we did a lot of interesting new things, like a low-alcohol Moscato. We made a new Sauvignon Blanc style that was just eye-poppingly good and put us on the map instantly. We really got into the Meritage thing at a time when nobody else wanted to do it. We made an un-oaked Chardonnay, a no-oaked Chardonnay, before everybody else started doing it. Most of these things now are so commonplace that you just think, this isn't interesting and new. Well, it was then. Nobody else was doing it then. In the middle of all this, well, at the beginning of all this, actually, a friend of mine goaded me into helping found an organization called Women for Wine Sense to save wine from the anti-alcohol people, which was, you know, just a little sideline of, you know, not much importance. But it was a major campaign. It was kind of like a crusade to save wine. And we burned up the copy machine because we couldn't send emails and PDFs and stuff. You had to send documents around. And lots of research on wine and health, and eventually made a real impact with that. And I'm happy to say that that organization is still alive and well 25 years later. Yay. It's all good. Well, I'm going to... Okay, I could talk to you a little bit about Act 3. Or I could tell you about Petunia. Let me tell you about Petunia. I should tell you that story because we did have some fun too at Saint-Supery. I don't want to make it sound like we didn't. The market had become much more competitive by the time I was at Saint-Supery. And so we had to work a lot harder to sell wine. Also, we were not making sparkling wine, which is a much smaller piece of the wine market than still wines, or flat wines, as we used to call them at Chandon. If it doesn't have bubbles, it's flat, right? I had to train myself into calling them still wines. Anyway, so you had to get more creative and inventive about how you were going to sell wines, because you could either throw money at it like the big guys do, which is, you know, the last man alive turns out the lights. That's that kind of an approach. Or you can be more creative and kind of what's going on today with internet marketing, where so much of what's going on is content. It's not just buy my product, these are its benefits, it's making friends with you. It's almost more like the Chandon Club, frankly. And then if there's a sale, it's almost, you know, that follows, it's not the lead item. Anyway, so we're figuring out ways to get some attention for our brand, especially around Napa, which by that time had a whole lot of new restaurants, which was great. But there were so many more new wineries, the competition to be on their wine list was just fierce. It remains fierce. And most of the restaurants actually rotate their lists constantly in order to accommodate the neighboring wineries. So even if you do get on a wine list in Napa, you're not on it for long, because as soon as that wine has been sold, then they're going to make space for somebody else. And everybody kind of gets that. So we were thinking, how can we have an unfair advantage here? And our vineyard manager said, well, I'm growing some really good peaches up here at the ranch, and maybe Cindy's pastry chef would like some of those peaches. And I said, that's an interesting idea. And if they like the peaches, maybe they'll like the wine too, you know, just sort of cement the relationship a little more. So he shows up with a flat of these incredible peaches just picked that morning. They're still warm from being on the tree. Takes them into Annie Baker, who's the pastry chef at Cindy's. And of course, Annie Baker falls all over them. And yeah, that's her name. It really is funny. She's gone off on her own now in her own company. And that started it. And that really created a nice little relationship with Cindy's Backstreet Kitchen and Mustard's, her other restaurant. So then the next idea, I'm having lunch in there one day, and Cindy walks by, and we were chatting, and I said, well, I'm glad you really like the peaches. What else have you got on your mind? You know, you're always looking for new things. And she says, heirloom pigs. I said, no, heirloom pigs. I had not heard of heirloom pigs myself at this point in my career. So I said, oh, yeah, really? What kind of heirloom pigs? And she says, red wattle and what's the other one? I just forgot. Shoot, the one that Petunia is. Anyway, two of them, right at the top of her fingertips. So she said, can you grow me some of those? And I said, well, I don't know, I'll ask. So I went back and talked to our vineyard manager, who should have been, you know, a real general farmer. I mean, vineyards are nice, but he liked to grow all kinds of things just to entertain himself, I think. So he said, oh yeah, I can do that. So he sends his assistant vineyard manager off to Omaha to pick up a pregnant sow. A Berkshire, that's the one, Berkshire. And so he drives Petunia all the way back out to Napa, installs her in the vineyard under a nice oak tree. They like acorns, by the way, a lot. That's what makes their meat taste good. And Petunia proceeded to produce a huge litter of pigs, and half of which died in a heat wave, including her, about a week later. And so our poor ranch manager had to bottle feed the rest of the litter, which was six or seven pigs. I mean, this turned into such a movie. And then we had to figure out how to get them slaughtered when the time came, because, you know, the FDA gets involved, da, 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 da. You have to drive them 6 hours up to somewhere up in the north part of California to have this happen. But it all worked out, and Cindy got her pork chops, her Berkshire pork chops. Everybody was happy until the day I made the big mistake of inviting my boss on one of his visits out to meet Petunia, who was really a personable pig. I mean, she was big and kind of wonderful, but she really liked company, and she would grunt happily if somebody came to visit her, and she'd arch her back to be scratched, and, you know, she was just happy if somebody paid some attention to her. So he knew she was there. The next thing that happens is the swine flu blow up all over the world, and my boss back in France is going, oh my God, if somebody gets swine flu from pork from Dollarhide Ranch, it's going to be a disaster. And I said, no, you know, I was going to shine it on, because I knew that this was, I didn't know, but I certainly thought that that would be fairly improbable. But he knew me well enough to know I was shining him on, so he called up my vineyard manager directly and said, get rid of Petunia. So, well, it wasn't Petunia, it was her progeny by that point. And then before 6 months had passed, all the press that had blown up swine flu into such a conflagration and such a disaster sort of, you know, admitted that, you know, swine flu isn't transmitted by pigs at all. It's transmitted by people. never mind. Anyway. The point of that is everybody has a boss, and you just have to deal with him. C'est la vie. Okay, so The last thing I was going to talk to you about very briefly was if I ever write an Act 3 for the book, which I probably won't, but I might. You know, I'll talk a little bit about what I'm doing now. Then the title, Bubbles to Boardrooms, is where this comes in, because that's one of the things I'm doing now is serving on boards. I was on the board of Silicon Valley Bank for 10 years, which was really fun. What a bunch of smart people who don't act like bankers at all. And I'm currently on the Bank of Marin board, but more interestingly for me, I'm on the advisory boards for two startup companies. And that's really fun because it just takes me right back to all these early days of starting up companies and having a good time sort of creating something out of nothing. There is the faint possibility that the book will get turned into a film. This has been suggested to me several times. And I don't know if that's ever going to happen, but if it is, I want Diane Keaton to play me. And Villa Ragazzi, which is very, very small. I mean, we make 100, 150 cases of wine a year, and we've been doing it for 25 years, 27 years now. Yeah, well, we're hoping that our 29-year-old son, who is in the wine business, will get excited about Villa Ragazzi and want to get involved in that. But so far, he's too busy doing his own thing in the wine business. But we're still sort of holding out. But if he decides he wants to get involved, then it's going to have to get bigger to provide him a living, because it's not big enough right now. I am hoping someday to be a good tennis player. I'm working on it. Grandparent, maybe in the offing, I don't know. I think my daughter is acutely aware of how old I was when I had her, and she's got a way to go yet. I might learn Italian someday. Anyway, I think doing the book has been really fun for me, and I think it's, again, people have been telling me what it means to them. It's not just stories of the wine business. It's stories about taking chances and sticking your hand up and asking for jobs. I didn't tell you the story about how I got the job at St. Supri, but I essentially asked for it. It's in the book. If you want something, if you figure out what you want, which is the hard part in my view, then it's the way to it becomes much easier. You find a way. And I hope, and I've had people tell me this, that especially young people, read this book and they go, oh, I could do that, instead of thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do. Or, ooh, I don't think I can do that. They get kind of encouraged to just give it a whack. And I think that's a pretty wonderful result. That makes me very happy. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Q&A. But first, I have to make another one of those announcements. This is for our listening audience. This is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you are listening to Sips and Reflections with Michaela Rodino. Now, Q&A, there's a right back there in the corner, back left corner, my back left corner, is a microphone. And the reason they want you to use the microphone to ask questions is because of the recording of the program. Otherwise, they'll lose the questions. So if you have questions, I will answer any question. No questions. Damn, somebody ask a question. Yay, you have to go back to the microphone. Don't bother to raise your hand. Just go back to the microphone.
Good evening. My name is William Rotemore. I'm a French translator, and I'd like to know what it was like to combine French and American sensibilities in your business experience.
Ooh, that's a very good question. That comes down to the culture thing again. This may be really unfair, but I don't think so. My sense of it is unless French culture has changed a lot recently, and I don't think it has, I think it should, but it hasn't yet, it would have been very, very difficult to try to combine a French workforce with an American workforce here. If we had sent some of our people off to France to work, they would have just gone along with whatever was going on in France temporarily. But we actually had a couple of experiences with French people because, I don't know if you know this, but French companies all have kind of a moral obligation to take in student interns, that with the idea that they are sort of recruiting for the company in the long term. American companies, of course, don't do that. You can get a summer job as an intern, but there's really no expectation that you're going to make a career with that company. But we had a few of those people, including some of Robert Scali's children and other relatives to deal with. And it's not the easiest thing to do. They have a different approach to work, certainly a different one from ours. I mean, ours was very free-form, Not a lot of rules, not a lot of structure. We expected everybody to help everybody else. You know, it was perfectly okay to get into somebody else's business because you were going to help them. It wasn't because you were trying to take over their job from them. And in France, you know, they kind of like those org charts where they know exactly where everybody belongs and exactly what they do. You know, there isn't that fluidity. So it would have been really difficult to combine those cultures in a work environment, I think. French culture is great, not at work. Yes.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed your talk tremendously. So I have a quick comment and then a question which won't be so easy for the listening audience.
Okay.
First of all, Jennifer Lawrence, not Diane Keaton.
Sorry?
If your book is turned into a film,
yeah,
I think you want Jennifer Lawrence to star.
Oh, okay. Do I know who Jennifer Lawrence is?
Yeah, she just won the Golden Globe in the movie Joy.
Okay.
And she's a comedian, and she's wonderful, and I think she would be perfect.
Thank you.
Anyway.
I'll Google her.
All right. So, not so good for the listening audience, but for all of us. I understand that you, I tasted a wonderful Gouda shortbread with the red wine, which I understand is homemade.
Correct.
So, are you going to market the recipe, or would you share it with us?
No, I am not going to go into the cookie business. Actually, it's not my recipe anyway. That is Sarah Scott's recipe. Sarah Scott is a wonderful cook who has worked for Robert Mondavi Winery for a long time and also does a lot of catering in Napa. I do have the recipe, and I'm perfectly happy to share it with you. She was good enough to post it on Facebook, so I grabbed it. And it's the reason I brought it is because it's so good. It's a savory shortbread that works beautifully with red wine. Just great. It's got rosemary in it and aged Gouda, and it's just... And they're easy to bake. It's like refrigerator cookies. So if you want the recipe, just, you know, give me your email, and I'll send it to you. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you for the presentation. My question relates to pricing. Hmm. Since you're a marketing person with an MBA, can you tell us some good stories about pricing of wine in the past, perhaps even in the recent past?
Yes, I could tell you lots of stories about pricing wine. Pricing wine is very difficult because it's not cost-based, at least not in Napa Valley, because you're so far beyond the cost. It's hard to spend enough money on producing wine in Napa Valley to make cost-based an issue. It's mostly about, and everybody's making the best wine they can. I mean, it's the quality game from the ground up. You know, even if you're spending $500, $600, $700, $800, even $1,000 a case on production, you know, grapes, winemaking, packaging, all that stuff, you're still going to sell it for a lot more than that. So, you know, $1,000 a case isn't that much. It's less than $100 a bottle. And there are plenty of Napa wines, not mine, but plenty of Napa wines that are in the several hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars at this point. So it's not cost that drives pricing. Is my point. What does drive pricing, and it's kind of silly, is partly looking at the market, comparing your wine to things that you think are comparable, and saying to yourself, this is the typical thing, my wine's that good. Or maybe it's even better. So I should get at least that much money, or maybe more than that guy. And this happens a lot with the newer wineries, too. There's been, in the last couple of decades, there's been a pretty big influx of money flowing into Napa. A lot of people arrive with a large fortune in their pockets and proceed to spend it on their wineries, and you know, but they don't have. They're the ones who are saying my wine is at least as good as this guy's, and so they're really pushing prices up. The old timers who have been around a long time, and I'll include myself in that, are much more modest about pricing because we just can't believe people are paying that much money for some of these wines. So it's hard, you know. I mean, our wines are $36 for the Sangiovese, and $48 for the Farona. Yeah. And we make a little bit of Cabernet at $60. Well, $60 Cabernet is probably average in Napa, mainly because there's so many really expensive wines, not in high volume, but very high prices that are pulling the averages way up. You can find Napa Cabernets you can find them for $30, but they must be losing their shirts. The old rule of thumb for pricing, and Mondavi used this for a long time, but I don't think it really works anymore, was to take the price of a ton of grapes and your bottle price would be 100. No, the grapes would be 100 times the bottle price, right? Is that how it worked? You think so? If you're going to have a $50 bottle of wine, you could afford to pay $5,000 for a ton of grapes. That was the idea. And I think he tried to float that with his growers for a long time, but eventually even that didn't work out. It's a very difficult question to answer because there is no real answer. Everybody's in it for themselves. And ultimately the market tells you whether you've gotten it right. You know, if people are buying your wine at whatever price you're putting it out there for, yeah, then it's okay. If you put it too high and it doesn't sell, that sends you a message. But most people are very reluctant to back off on, you know, lowering price. If you're too low, you sell out too fast, that's a good message because then you do have some room to move up a little bit. But you want to be selling out every vintage because you don't want them piling up. Every year you get another batch of wine that you have to sell. So you want to get that right if you can, but it's very tricky. And then, of course, when you sell it into the distribution system, if you do, you lose control of pricing completely. Once it's out the door of the winery, I mean, you can try, that's called price fixing, you can try to convince your wholesalers and the retailers and restaurants that carry your wine that you would like to see the pricing in this range, but they're under no obligation to listen to you. So it's a sticky thing. Frankly, I will admit, I'm the first one to admit, I don't think I ever got it right. It's kind of like making sales projections, you know, because you have to figure out how much wine to make for reds, three years in advance. So you're looking off into the future and trying to figure out how much wine to make, you know, from what you've got available that day. And, you know, the rookies, I've got a wonderful graph in the book, actually, that shows my first projections at Saint-Supery with this really nice straight upward line. That was revenue. And then similar straight but smaller lower lines, you know, for costs. And then there was even some profit up there toward the end of this 10-year graph. But the problem is it never works like that. There's no such thing as a straight line in real life. You know, it goes up, it goes down. You know, on average, you can do a trend line, okay, through that. That would be a straight line. But it's never like that. It's always bumping all over the place. So the way I look at it is you make your sales projections, you do the best you can, and you know, the market's doing what it's doing, and your projections are like that, and periodically these two lines cross. And when they cross, that's the magic moment when you've got it right for a very small period of time. Otherwise, you've got too much wine or too little wine. Makes it fun. Yes?
I'm curious what predictions you have for the wine industry, say, over the next 10 years in terms of evolution or new developments.
Oh, wow. Next 10 years. Well, I mean, I can't speak for the whole wine industry because that's a pretty dynamic and diverse animal. There's clearly a trend for the lower end of the market to go away in California. You know, the under $10 bottles of wine are just being bumped out of the way by less expensive imports, basically, from South America notably, but other places as well. At the top end of the market, there seems to be still room. In fact, bottles over $10, $20 a bottle is where all the strong growth is. And so as long as people are still, you know, making decent money and have some, you know, disposable income, if they like wine, they're going to keep sort of ratcheting up as, you know, wine is like that. Wine is, it has an intellectual character to it and a hedonistic character to it that I think people, certain types of people really like. And they'll just keep exploring it because there's so much to explore. So I think the future is very bright. And the millennials, my son is one, the latest is they're Gen Y, aren't they? Yeah, they're Gen Y. They're a bigger cohort than the boomers. And I used to worry about what happens to the wine business when the boomers all start fading away, which is what's going on now, because it wasn't clear that the generations right behind us were that interested in wine. Well, the millennials just dove right in there. As soon as started drinking, they were drinking wine. So I have totally relaxed about the future of the wine business. I think it's very strong. Yes.
In addition to the marketing programs that you've done, what are the smartest campaigns other people have done, the ones that you wish you did?
Yeah. Wow. I hadn't thought about that. Let me think. You know, in terms of advertising, there's so little advertising in the wine business because most of the companies are really small. And it's only the really large companies that have ad budgets in the classic marketing sense.
But what about the other sort of things like the clubs, other creative ways of engaging or consumer?
In our end of the business, which is the high end of the business, public relations has always really been the major way of communicating. And now, of course, with the internet, that's shifting toward direct contact instead of indirect through the media. Now it's direct contact with consumers, which is something that I've always been really big on, even before electronics and the internet happened. You know, it seemed to me that those are the people who are going to drink your product. So those are the ones you really want to be talking to, not everybody in between you and those people. That's what the Chandon Club was really all about. And I think you see that happening everywhere now. Frankly, the way wine clubs have been going, they may be about to save themselves, but there's up until very recently, so many of them were just so intent on picking your pocket. You know, some of you, you're shaking your heads. You probably felt this. If you've gone into a tasting room, you're getting a hard sell to join the club. And maybe you want to join the club, and that's fine. And maybe you don't. Maybe you're just interested in visiting the winery and maybe buying a couple of bottles. But so there was a real risk. That created a risk that the clubs would self-destruct. You know, but I think from the latest glimmerings I'm getting, there's a lot of training going on in the wine business right now about how better to deal with consumers. We're all consumers. But, you know, how to engage with them, how to make friends with them, how to bring them into your sphere of influence and to like you fundamentally, like me, like my products. And that's a good thing that's starting to happen, because I was getting a little worried about wine clubs, frankly. Does that answer your question? Thank you for letting me off the hook. Yes.
How's the interest in craft beers cutting into the wine sale business?
Oh, that's a good question. The bigger producers are worried about craft beers because they are a force. And they seem to attract the same kind of consumer that wines do. So there are people who are pretty concerned about that. With a few exceptions, they are very fragmented, very small operations, just the way the wine business is. But they have a few biggies out there, too, that tend to get gobbled up by other conglomerates. You know, like Sierra Nevada, for example. That started off as a craft beer, and now it's huge. And what was the one, Gregory, that was just over in Sonoma? Yeah, Lagunitas just got sold for $60 million, something like that. More than that? Well, whatever. It was a lot of money. But they started off really small, too. Heineken bought them, yeah. Well, you see that happening. All these big breweries that have a hard time masquerading as microbreweries and craft breweries are just gobbling them up. And the same thing is happening in the wine business. A lot of the small wineries are being gobbled up by bigger wineries because the big wineries, you know, don't have the credibility to create those kinds of brands. It's easier to buy them. And people, you know, they age out of the business, too. They want to sell. They want to go sit on their yacht, you know, instead of farming the rest of their lives. Anyway. Well, if there aren't any more questions, I think we'll wrap it up. I hope everybody got a chance to taste the Faraona. And there's one more wine back there, the Moscato, which is a little bit sweet, but it's got really good acidity. And it's very low in alcohol. It's a nice, refreshing kind of fruity wine from Saint-Supery. So thank you all for coming and for your attention. I'm delighted to be here with you tonight. Thank you.
On behalf of the club, I would like to thank Michaela Rodino for being here tonight. And I would also like to thank our audience, both here in San Francisco and our listening audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating the 113th year of the club, is officially adjourned.